Hello, Acid Horizon listeners. This is Craig. It is May of 2022, and there's some exciting stuff happening this month. For one thing, we are going to meet with Stuart Kendall. He is a translator, and you might know him from his translations of the work of George Bataille. We will be recording a live episode with Stuart, which will likely be broadcast on Twitch and YouTube. The topic for discussion is George Bataille, Nietzsche or Communism. The entry point for the discussion will be George Bataille's and Asifal's Nietzschean Turn. We will discuss some of the milestone moments in the establishment of French communism with Nietzsche as a primary mediator. Moreover, we will discuss the implications and relevance for Bataille's work and the writings of Asifal in today's political milieu. Today we are talking about the work of Aimé Césaire and his essay Discourse on Colonialism. Let's get started. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. On this episode, we're going to be looking at the work of Aimé Césaire, focusing on his 1950 work, Discourse on Colonialism. Césaire was a Martinican poet and communist politician who was one of the leading figures in the emancipatory movements of the French-speaking colonial sphere, as well as a poetic voice central to the cultivation of contemporary forms of radical political blackness. Today we intend to highlight some of the political ideas as they come through Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism. And also, we will look at the criticisms he levels against contemporary French academics of his time period, whom he addresses for their problematic views. Now, there were several pieces that we could have chosen from. However, this is a piece that Adam had on the table for a while. I thought it was an interesting choice. Adam, maybe you want to say a few things as to why you picked this piece.
So this piece has been sort of floating around in my attention span for a while, and I'm particularly a fan of Césaire when it comes to thinking about universalism beyond a kind of abstract universal, an abstract fixed or rigid kind of idea of universals as something that we sort of force onto our people, imprint upon them to force them into these type categories and these type molds. And what I love particularly about this text, Discourse on Colonialism, is, I mean, as Robin D.G. Kelly says in the beginning of this, it is a sort of a grand declaration of war, this text. It's a third world insurrectionary kind of graffiti, a poetic jam of attack across the entire sort of Western canon. And I really do think in terms of the poetics and the rhetoric of this attack that Césaire is putting forward, I mean, he is showing sort of the core, the rot of the dialectic of Europe. I mean, to quote Cedric Robinson, a society for its own perverse assumptions and contradictions has been set loose upon the world. And the society is Europe, and Césaire is really coming at the heart of Europe here in terms of its own dialectics of self-recognition, its self-consciousness and self-reflection, where its own sort of formal humanist kind of principles, where it sees itself as the guarantor of the rights of man and the sovereign nation, have actually produced nothing else but its very opposite, what itself would call barbarism and savagery. Colonialism is incompatible with civilization for Césaire, and I think he lays this out in such a brilliant way, and we still see this critique resonate today, even when other leftist figures become so disillusioned with the idea of Europe and think that there is no such redemption, there's no fluffy, ode to joy, ideological resolution, something like you. We have someone like Franco Berardi saying that, no, sort of in a way, Césaire was right. The ultimate conclusion of the European project and sort of the overcoding of the European identity is this colonialism, its barbarism, and its pure kinds of violence. So I wanted to bring this text in purely as a sort of to bask in it to some extent, because I love the poetics of it. I love the forcefulness of its own dialectical inversions. I particularly like how it critiques humanism, its very formal, rigid sense. And I think it's something that I think every sort of leftist thinking about decolonial sort of practice and theory should really be going for. So this text is particularly Marxist, but it has the particular core of what Césaire would be doing, because Césaire was not only a poet and a theorist, but of course a very prominent politician. He was a member of France's National Assembly for over 30 years, part of the president of the Council of Martinique for about 3 or 4 years, and of course he was working with all these other poets in the movement to create a political blackness, people like in Damas, and of course Senghor, the first president of Senegal. And this is all about a logic of making universal It's about changing the relationship between the universal and the particular for Césaire. There's a great quote from an interview where he's talking to Senghor, and he remarks that, look, I found this great Hegel quote and I showed it to Senghor, and he says, you know, Hegel says, one should not oppose universal to particular. It is not by negating the particular that one reaches the universal, but by exploration and clear recognition of the particular. So we told ourselves, the blacker we are going to be, the more universal we will become. I don't think in terms of antagonism. I am myself wherever men stand and struggle. Hence my way of relating, this is paradoxical, to this land, to the land of Martinique, to the very colonized aspect in which he's working. And he's trying to sort of reverse the notion of universality as something very abstract and almost like a transcendental conceptual heaven sort of floating over the world, and bring universal in particular into a greater conversation. And he's going to do that through the singularity of the experience of the colonized, particularly of the black colonized subject. And he summarized this description beautifully in a quote from his letter, actually, when he resigns from his position or his membership of the Communist Party of France, particularly after the Khrushchev secret speech, and also, of course, their particular reticence to engage with the Algerian struggle, which was what many Marxists at the time were criticizing the PCF for. It wasn't that they were anti-Marxist, that they were anti the PCF, because I think it's a very justified position to be in that, given their particular reticence, although many PCF members were particularly good during that period. But this is the quote from Césaire on the universal. So, my conception of the universal is that of a universal enriched by all that is particular. A universal enriched by every particular. The deepening and coexistence of all particulars. And so we need to have the patience to take up the task anew. The strength to redo that which has been undone. The strength to invent instead of follow. The strength to invent our path and to clear it of ready-made forms. Those petrified forms that obstruct it. Now, those petrified forms are absolutely the forms of racial ideology and colonial subjectivation that's been imposed from above. The so-called savage is a construction of Europe and its mirror image, because all it can do is savagery to the external world. And it's something brought up amazingly by Robinson in the Black Marxism text, which is that racial subjectivation requires, as an ideological force, a constitutive erasure of the past, which it tries to itself colonize by colonizing the heads of the colonized. And this is very dehumanizing for both. And Césaire wants to point out, this is dehumanizing for both. And my God, Europe, you're turning insane. You've even created your own little Hitlers. It's flipped back upon yourselves. But of course, I've got a bit of post-COVID vocal fry, so I'm going to leave it a bit there.
Well, firstly, I thought Adam did a really good job explaining some of that stuff, because I'm less familiar with Césaire's work, so I'm coming into this a little bit fresh. But I had some thoughts on it. I mean, firstly, I really liked it. I loved sort of the tone of the language, sort of this sort of really sort of righteous anger flowing through the entire thing, as he just, and particularly once maybe about halfway through, two-thirds through, when he really starts hammering some of his contemporary, you know, authors and thinkers and so on for some blatantly racist and completely unacceptable statements that they make, not just once or twice, but, you know, quite systematically claims they make, which serve to uphold the system of colonization. So I really enjoy that aspect. And I also like that he sort of touches on quite a few different areas in relation to colonization. I think there's probably four main focuses for him. One is trying to connect up the history of colonization with what had just happened in Europe in World War II. Because he was writing this, if I'm correct, in 1955. And so, you know, he and much of America and Europe is trying to still, frankly, trying to come to terms with what had happened there, particularly in Germany with fascism and the Holocaust and so on. And one of the really interesting sort of threads that he pursues here is trying to show that what happened there was always going to happen, really, given the way that colonization had proceeded. There's a passage where he says, "What he cannot forgive Hitler for is not crime in itself, the crime against man. It is not the humiliation of man as such. It's the crime against the white man, the humiliation of a white man, and the fact that he applied to Europe colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria and India and of Africa and so on." And that's an idea colonialism sort of comes home to roost in World War II that other authors have also explored. When I read it, I remembered a section from Society Must Be Defended by Foucault, where he also talks about this. And it's also a pretty persistent theme in Adorno's writing, in Minima Moralia, that the history of Western civilization culminates in Auschwitz, I think Adorno says pretty much word for word. So I really appreciated that explanation. Then towards the end, if I could say one last thing, I really liked the way that he tackles some of the other thinkers that he's reading and writing about, and really doesn't let them off the hook at all. And yeah, I thought it was a really brilliant piece, scathing, beautifully articulated, covered a really wide range of sort of topics related to colonialism. And yeah, I'll leave it there for sort of opening sort of thoughts on it.
I think the one thing that's really worth digging into here is the idea that the concept of civilization and the concept of colonization are contradictions, and that society cannot be deemed civilized insofar as it practices colonization. This is one of the overriding themes. And this is something that we've brushed up against in other episodes, where there's a certain image of thought attached to the notion of civilization or the axiom of civilizing force. And Cesare goes right after that in the beginning here. And although it appears as a grace note, I think, throughout the whole of this essay, there's a critique of psychoanalysis, at least in the figure of Manoni, for sure. But there's also this idea of projection or othering, a thread that runs through this essay too, that is something that I really landed on here. So I just want to read what I believe is one of the most important paragraphs in this, because I think, you know, as Matt said, there's a very strong rhetorical element to this particular piece. And I think to pay homage to it, it needs to be read out loud. And so basically, Cesare is going to give us a definition of what is colonization? So here he goes. He says, in other words, the essential thing here is to see clearly, to think clearly, that is, dangerously, and to answer clearly the innocent first question, what fundamentally is colonization? To agree on what it is not, neither evangelization, nor a philanthropic enterprise, nor a desire to push back the frontiers of ignorance, disease, and tyranny, nor a project undertaken for the greater glory of God, nor an attempt to extend the rule of law. To admit once and for all, without flinching at the consequences, that the divisive actors here are the adventurer and the pirate, the wholesale grocer and the ship owner, the gold digger and the merchant, appetite and force, and behind them, the baleful projected shadow of a form of civilization which at a certain point in history finds itself obliged, for internal reasons, to extend to world scale the competition of its antagonistic economies. Which is to say that the notion of civilization and all of the presuppositions it carries with it flows through its actors. And many of the targets that Cesare identifies in this essay say things and go on the record in a way that is just ripe for pulling apart from a psychoanalytic perspective. There's one particular individual he points out, Colonel de Montagnac, one of the conquerors of Algeria, says, in order to banish the thoughts that sometimes besiege me as a conqueror, I have some heads to cut off, not the heads of artichokes, but the heads of men. And just coming at this from a sort of general psychoanalytic perspective here, using the notion of projection or the tension of opposites that's induced by the kinds of internal antagonisms that occur as one becomes a colonizer, when one is fraught perhaps with guilt or sees the brutality that they visit on other people. What does that person do in that moment? Do they take account of that? No, they reap more murder. And so I thought this would be a good point to leave off and let Will say a few things.
Yeah, I think this piece is fascinating because of the intensity it carries throughout. I don't think it ever quite lets up. I found one thing to be interesting is that it carries with it the same kind of approach to, now there's an explicit homage to Fanon right at the end, but the piece sort of carries with it this function of how colonizing forces slowly but surely result in a kind of alienation that permeates throughout the sort of societal networks of the colonizing countries. And I thought that was extremely close to some of the things that we'd be reading in, say, Fanon, specifically in The Wretched of the Earth. At the same time, I also think that there are some relatively unique elements here that come to signify a new way in which the very civilizing force of European society is a thingification turned inward, right? The reason why, say, these forces of colonization function to sort of sap labor power from these individuals in order to sap labor power from them, incarcerate them, etc. For the European, this then becomes a sort of pathological mode of operation that then gets turned inward, right? Because the thing that is so condemnable about the colonized population is their idiocy, their laziness, and what have you. And what we find, and obviously, you know, Matt already spoke to this, is that these technologies of policing that become so fundamental to the refinement of productive processes in the colonies then find their way to come back home. And I actually think that there's a relatively contemporary example that we can use to show that this may have not a transhistoricality, but at least a sort of repetition in colonization and occupation. And that would be some of the military police tactics that we saw utilized by state and federal forces that would become occupying forces of cities during the George Floyd uprising. The very police practices that became fundamental to the occupations of places like Kabul find a way back to streets in Minnesota, in Colorado. And what we see is that processes of colonial violence do sort of reap return and return in a sort of internalization, where the police mechanism that is used on these thoroughly dehumanized subjects always become then constitutive elements of the very practice of policing throughout the network. So I thought that was one interesting element here, because it personates in the practices of the SS, right, in the manifestation of Hitler. But what he wants to show is that this is not just some one individual madman who manifests from Germanic society, like a particular, you know, Himmler, but in fact it's, or Hitler, but in fact it's an entirely, it's entirely contemporaneous with the very thought processes of the white bourgeois classes in Europe.
In this thesis of Césaire's that the so-called barbarism of colonization returns to the imperial core, and especially as you said, Will, the form of policing, we know what this is. I was speaking to, you know, for the Cedric Robson episode of Zero Books, I was speaking to Kieran Turner from Palestine Action, and Elbit Systems, the drone manufacturers, sell their weapons as with the advertisement that it is battle-tested on colonized people, on Palestinians. We can see this. The so the beauty of Césaire's text is how imminent it is to every ongoing form of colonial struggle. It's just this time these British manufacturers like Elbit managed to put this on the market.
Yeah, like those, and maybe Craig will know more about this, but those American sunglasses ads, you know, the sports sunglasses ads, where it's like, these are the ones the soldiers use, you know, in between the clips of atrocities across the world, you know, they're still marketing the very technologies. It's like, oh, these are the same military grade technology thermoplastics.
That's just about everything you find on Alex Jones's channel these days. They have even tactical tater tots or some shit, right? But Matt, you had something. Didn't want to cut you
off.
Yeah,
I wanted to come back and add something there, because this the concept of humanism has come up a few times already. And Adam sort of indicated that he was little bit unsure where to place this text in relation to humanism. Now, I'm not certain, and I'm certainly not an expert on Césaire, but here's sort of the reading I took from it. I think what he's trying to attack is specifically European humanism, that sort of a European humanism that holds itself up as guarantors of like individual liberty, freedom, and justice, and so on and so forth. And yet, in so many cases, does not practice what it preaches. There's a particularly brutal and quite biting passage, which I think Craig's right. We ought to read some of this out loud, just for listeners who don't have it in front of them. So, and this is all a quotation from Césaire. He says, "The conclusion is inescapable. Compared to the cannibals, the dismemberers, and other lesser breeds, Europe and the West are the incarnation of respect for human dignity. But let us move on, and quickly, lest our thoughts wander to Algiers, Morocco, and other places where, as I write these words, so many valiant sons of the West, in the semi-darkness of dungeons, are lavishing upon their inferior African brothers, with such tireless attention, those authentic marks of respect for human dignity, which are called, in technical terms, electricity, the bathtub, and the bottleneck." And it's just, when I read that earlier, that seems to me to be what he's going after here. I don't know if it's sort of a humanism in general. I think he's more thinking about the way that Europe portrays itself, the way that it almost has to think of itself in this way in order to solve its conscience over the reality of what it is actually doing, right? And so perhaps the idea would be more of a humanism that was able to get past this in some sense. I'm not sure about that much, but I think that passage in particular indicates that might be where he wants to go with this idea. And I think it's a really important one as well, because you see this, you know, many of the passages here, you know, suggest the fact that at least at the time, Césaire was a committed sort of communist and Marxist thinker. And this is, I think, a sort of common line of thinking among Marxists is that, you know, part of what ideology does is it serves to normalize and justify the existing relations of, you know, exploitation and domination. So maybe that's one reading you could take there. And I did have just one other little thought just before I think Adam might have some thoughts there, but there's this really interesting passage. Again, this is sort of building on sort of these sort of Marxist undertones I'm getting on this text. There's a section where he talks about Bantu philosophy. And again, I'd actually like to just read it, because I think it's a really powerful and quite biting sort of passage. So he writes, quote, "Now then, know that Bantu thought is essentially ontological, that Bantu ontology is based on the truly fundamental notions of a life force and a hierarchy of life forces, and for the Bantu, the ontological order which defines the world comes from God, and as a divine decree must be respected. Wonderful. Everybody gains. The big companies, the colonists, the government, everybody except the Bantu, of course. Since Bantu thought is ontological, the Bantu ask only for satisfaction of an ontological nature. Decent wages, comfortable housing, food. These Bantu are pure spirits, I tell you. What they desire first of all and above all is not an improvement of their economic or material situation, but the white man's recognition of and respect for their dignity as men, their full human value. In short, you tip your hat to the Bantu life force, you give a wink to the immortal Bantu soul, and that's all it costs you. You have to admit you're getting off cheap." And I thought that was not only a sort of brilliant sort of satirization there. I forget the name of the author he's quoting, though. It's Temples, I think it is. Brilliant sort of satire of what's really going on underneath the kind of supposed respect for, you know, difference, contact, and so on. But it almost reminded me of the sort of thing you find in Edward Said's Orientalism, although that would only be written 20 years, I think, after this paper. But this idea that Orientalism is at least in part this an exoticization, an othering as well at the same time, which can serve exactly the same purposes in many cases as a kind of more critical sort of analysis of a culture or idea or so on, that it's a kind of fake respect for another culture's idea or philosophy or tradition. But in material terms, it's really only respected insofar as it can be weaponized or utilized to. I thought that was another great passage I wanted to bring up before I forgot about it.
No, absolutely. Because, I mean, the distribution of life forces as an idea. I mean, I understood this text surprise from a very Stirnerite perspective, because I think there's a lot of Stirner quotes that very much fit into the kind of humanism that Césaire is criticizing. I mean, there's a great quote from Stirner, you know, "The humanist, the humane person, they don't love you for you. They love the essence within you. They do not love the particular human being, especially a particular colonized human being, particular black human being. They love the difference within them, this distribution along this great chain of hierarchical being. And that is why they can treat all kinds of particularities, particular people, with such disdain and such violence." As Stirner said, these humane people, these men of human liberalism, they love the human being. And that is why they cut the heads off of human beings. And this is the logic of terror, where the abstraction dominates everything possible. The abstract ideal of an emptied human essence and its particular rights and determinations has the sort of the stale air of what was once called the sort of European God, a hollowed out abstraction, and in whose name you could do everything is permitted. And it's this formal humanism that Césaire is attacking, I believe, because he says that Hitler is formal humanism plus philosophic renunciation. A renunciation of knowledge, you do not want to properly know the other, and the humanism is only ever categorical, only ever formal. So because his notion of essence, for example, he talks about people's essences being destroyed under the colonialism. It's not that they're mutable, sort of rigid concept is being destroyed. It's that, no, for him, the essence is sort of an essence, as Malibu would put it, without essentialism, a living community of particulars who form sort of a collective singular event of living together fraternally and communally. And that is what is being destroyed by the abstract idea of the human, which gives you your bourgeois property rights and your abstract sovereignty in your average nation, so in your sovereign nation. By liberating people, they give you the freedom to own property, of course, but in the conditions of setting up private property, they completely destroy the process by which anyone can own anything. And because the wealth of the area becomes a commonwealth, it becomes publicly owned from a universal, going into an abstract universal public, which localizes itself in where? Europe. The space of the essence of man, where someone like Feuerbach or Hegel, the founder of this sort of philosophic racism par excellence, if not the founder, at least the extender of it, man is realized as Christian, as white, as European in this particular geographic area, and its unity is only so far as it defines itself against the uncivilized. And in defining itself against the uncivilized, this formal abstract humanity has nothing else but the rigidity of its own terroristic actions and can reveal itself only in its opposite, that is, as the savagery which it defines. That is formal humanism, and for Césaire, that is Hitlerism.
I think at this point, it could be nice to turn the discussion towards some of the targets that Césaire aims at, namely the figure of Monsieur Manoni, the psychoanalyst, and Roger Caillois. And maybe I'll just say a couple things about the section on Manoni. Césaire positions psychoanalysis here as a negative strategy of the colonizer against the colonized, and uses the example of Manoni as somebody who cast the colonized subject as a dependent subject. And once again, it's best just to turn to the text, because what Césaire does here is really nice. Césaire says, as for Monsieur Manoni, in view of his book and observations on the Madagascan soul, he deserves to be taken very seriously. Follow him step by step through the ins and outs of his little conjuring tricks, and he will prove to you as clear as day that colonization is based on psychology, that there are in this world groups of men who, for unknown reasons, suffer from what must be called a dependency complex, that these groups are psychologically made for dependence, that they need dependence, that they crave it, ask for it, demand it, that this is the case with most of the colonized people and the way with the Madagascans in particular. Away with racism, away with colonialism. They smack too much of barbarism. Monsieur Manoni has something better, psychoanalysis. Embellished with existentialism, it gives astonishing results. The most down-at-heel cliches are resold for you and made good as new. The most absurd prejudices are explained and justified, and as if by magic or miraculation, I might say, the moon is turned into green cheese. It's interesting because I was listening to, just yesterday, the Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour, and they were talking about the body without organs under capital, miraculating power, and the notion of an apparent objective movement. And from the standpoint of ideology and bringing in psychoanalysis as a justification for the support, the necessary support we must give these people, really a similar inversion happens between labor and capital and what we see here, the colonizer and the colonized. Who is the one who's truly dependent upon whom for their profit? Once again, we have this a kind of mysticism in the psychoanalysis here, positioning the colonized subject as the dependent one. But maybe Adam can say something about Roger Caillois.
Yes. Well, before we get to that, I mean, just it probably goes without saying, but a good friend of Césaire and someone who considers Césaire one of his greatest teachers, who very much took this position onwards and extended it and sort of used the weapon of psychoanalysis against the colonized project was Frantz Fanon, fellow traveler from Martinique, very much used this. And to think about Carlois, I mean, given what Césaire points out and what Carlois said here, what the fuck happened to that man? I mean, for one, this stuff isn't mentioned at all on his Wikipedia page, and there is still, I believe, a sort of grand prize for writing on Carlois. He's mostly known as sort of an anthropologist of play, but we know him on Acid Horizon from his younger days when he was more of an anti-fascist, sort of in the 20s and 30s, because he was a member of Asaphal, the cult of sort of Dionysian anti-fascist transgression. Of course, very much anthropologically aligned, but you can see with Carlois that maybe he took some of the stuff and sort of completely ran with it into some pretty dark places. But yeah, the critique of Carlois here is primarily because of Carlois's chauvinism, the idea that he believes in this notion, I believe it's translated as particularism, which is a notion that the founder eventually did away with. But it was the idea that essentially only sort of Western people or white people could think in logical categories and say things about getting caught, can think in terms of universals and, you know, can think about universal forms and apply them to particular, whereas everyone else is stuck in the particular. And this is why, according to Carlois, ethnography is only white, and this is why we have these great universal ideas of universal fraternity and universal humanity and human rights. And Carlois says that the Westerners, they don't kill their infirm and their old, and they don't eat them either. I have to admit, the tradition of eating, we only socially devour our less fortunate. And for Carlois to say that that we don't kill our old and infirm, I mean, for God's, this is the constant that invented eugenics. I mean, I would arguably perhaps it invented almost every dominant strain and apparatus of contemporary ableism. I mean, Will, if you'd like to go off for about 4 hours on this, I mean, come on.
Before you go, and I'm going to let you go off hard. As Adam was talking, I just took it upon myself to Google search, and I don't even know why this occurred to me, Roger Caillois and Charles de Gaulle. I had to look it up. Like, how would a leftist in the post-war era in France ever come to those positions, or how might it be the case that they find a place where those positions manifest? And the name de Gaulle just popped into my head, and sure enough, I just found this PDF. It's called The Edge of Surrealism, a Roger Caillois reader, and it turns out, it says, here's just a line from it, and this is reaching out to our fans and listeners right now. Maybe they can fill in the blanks for us here, but it says, Caillois' strictly political response to the war was to play a founding role in the Comité de Gaulle, which he tried to hold back from a French nationalist outlook. Interesting.
Well, maybe he was just reading Kautsky instead.
I mean, like, unironically, yeah. Like, those forces are not particularly far away. Like, there's a long history of, like, left sympathies to Gaullism. Like, this bled all the way up until, like, the mid-70s. So this is not a surprise at all. I find it really fascinating that Caillois makes arguments about race from a position of an epistemology about race. Like, he is attempting to sort of make an argument about stock superiority, right? These are blood and soil kinds of arguments from a position of like the historical force of racism. And for me, like, Caillois reeks of the bad ending of doing, you know, ethnology and the anthropology of, like, the post-Nietzschean kind. Like, Caillois should be, like, a warning signal to everyone who flirts with these works that it has to be done extremely carefully, because, like, you know, one day you're sitting with a copy of, like, Clastres or Levi-Strauss or Nietzsche or whatever, and the next year you've got the skull measuring devices, right? But what I found so compelling about the critique of Caillois is that it seems to invert and make clear
that the way in which Kai Waz positioned himself is to try to be a force against some sort of guilt or disillusionment, where what we end up seeing is the deepest kind of resentment manifesting in this attempt to assert oneself as a kind of force against reactive forces. Because in the final analysis, like, what is Kai Waz other than the guiltiest man alive? And I think that what this piece does really well is, first of all, Western society is predicated on a eugenic circumscription, that this is just not going to be stepped around. The history of ontology and the history of, like, political participation makes this fundamentally clear from Aristotle onwards, and maybe even earlier. But what I think is really interesting is Kai Waz's assertion that these very modes of thinking that result in the kind of epistemologies of domination, like, Kai Waz wants to assert that the West alone knows how to think. But at the same time, the only way in which Kai Waz can engage in this otherization is by having to concede the entirety of, like, scientific practice in the rest of the world. The entire history of scientific practice cannot exist for Kai Waz. So in the end, it's terrible anthropology, it's utterly racist, and finally nonsensical and guilt-ridden in the Nietzschean sense. So on all fronts is an embarrassment here. Like, and there is no space left in discourse on colonialism where Kai Waz is not pinged. And I think the thoroughness of the treatment of this notion that Kai Waz brings up of primitiveness, I think, is interesting. But it also, at the same time, allows us to see the very dangers of making assertions about who is civilized, what is being civilized, too.
I mean, I think it's entirely ironic, too, given he was the writer of the Dionysus piece and the Sacred Conspiracy.
He wrote the Dionysian Virtues, and he also wrote The Winter Wind, which is a point on sort of just the making sacred of things and sort of we called it inverted Stirnerism, but maybe he had the same similar reading to Mussolini of Stirner, which is not a good one.
Well, the way that I see it is, from a Nietzschean perspective, you have somebody who has cut themselves off from this, which they think is other to themselves in the form of the primitive person, and then has made themselves feel guilty about that in some way, to the extent that the other side of themselves needs to help that other side out, yet maintains that dehumanizing split. To me, that speaks of the most monstrous of self-splitting that I can imagine in some ways, with the exception perhaps of just brute fascism. You know, this is the kind of long game of liberalism, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, like, the brilliance here is, in the end, what he's asserting that I think is so brilliant is, like, liberal intentionality is entirely contemporaneous with the manifestation of Hitlerite humanism. And we've said it earlier, this is not some sort of fundamental break, but, like, he lays out the entire field, and to a certain extent, like, it gets to the level of crude comedy when at length Kai Waz is quoted making assertions physiologically about how a quality cannot exist within corporeality, right? And, like, Kai Waz's fangs that he projects onto those that European bourgeois nations have subjugated becomes the very foundation through which he can actually justify subjugation and brutal colonial violence. Because what is written here, and it's quoted at length, is, for the question of the equality of races, people, or cultures has meaning only if we are talking about an equality in law, an equality under the nomos. And then he goes on to say, in the same way, men who are blind, maimed, sick, feeble-minded, ignorant, or poor are not respectively equal in the material sense of the word to those who are strong, clear-sighted, whole, healthy, intelligent, cultured, or rich. And the absolute violence, the white, able-bodied violence that comes through, you can almost smell it as it comes across on the page. So I found it so fascinating that up top, Kaiwa is saying that there's a cat on screen and it's very adorable. So it's very hard to talk about these utterly horrifying things with an adorable kitten in frame. But up top, Kaiwa is saying, well, we're not like these others that we subjugate, for we do not engage in cannibalism. We just engage in this cannibalism. And the figure of the cannibal for this paper then becomes a kind of ironic hat, right? He tips his cannibal's hat to the other violent vampiric cannibal.
I'm glad you brought the thing up about the split between the ethical dimension and the legal dimension of equality, because it almost seems as if Kaiwa's view sets him and anybody who espouses that view up for this whole state of exception thing. You know, like, hey, this is what happens at the level of law, right? But there's this other order of righteousness or domination or moral rectitude or whatever you want to call it, where this other thing happens and that happens outside of law.
Yeah, like isonomia can only be applied to, well, those who are respectively equal in a material sense of the word. Then we can have a discussion about equality, right? But it has to first, you know.
I want to hear the lines after that section, though, because it gets better / worse / more sublime.
Yeah,
horrifying. Because so the last bit of a passage that Césaire is going to quote were, and as you're listening to this, like at home, whatever, just like think about these lines and like think about whether you've actually heard someone in real life say these. This sentence, quote, these differences entail an inequality. In fact, they in no way justify an inequality of rights in favor of the superior peoples, as racism would have it. Rather, they confer upon them additional tasks and an increased responsibility. End quote. And that's the one that Césaire's quoting from. It will took some lines out of just. And then I love this because he says, additional tasks? What are they if not the task of ruling the world? Increased responsibility. What is it, if not responsibility for the world? And so, you know, colonialism comes right back in at the end here. And the thing that I found so strange reading that is I've definitely, like, heard someone say that sort of thing before. Oh, well, you know, there may be material inequalities, but, you know, that doesn't mean that we could justify illegal inequalities and so on and so forth. Like, I'm sure other people have heard people say that before. And he's reading that from, like, a century ago. And then he just asks them to say the quiet bit out loud, really. That's what I think he's. I liked him as those last two lines, like additional tasks, increased responsibilities. You know, like I thought it was a really. I love that part.
I love this text so much. I mean, particularly as well, he's asking them. Well, in a way, as sort of European or sort of American subjects, he's asking that form of subjectivity. Because this is a discourse on colonialism, and he's using kind of the colonist language, you know, to be a bit Derridian about it. And he's saying to Europe in 1955 that, look, you're doing what Rome did was essentially externalize its borders, creating only destroying all kinds of all the cities and civilizations around it, and creating only sort of the very thing that would destroy it in the form of the Teutons in what would then become Germany, for example. He says that, well, Europe, you've already created this. You've already created the United States. And the United States is looking upon these your collapsing order and is saying, look, we can do business with these guys, these new colonies. And of course, if you want a good source on this, you turn to someone like Kwame Nkrumah and his book on neocolonialism. And he's offering a branch to Europe by saying, look, you need to support us. Oh, actually, no, you need to support us. You need to commit yourself to the one cause that could sort of not restore, but to promote a order based on the fraternities that you have destroyed, the fraternal communal atmosphere, the living essences of our lives, rather than the fixed ones you imposed upon us. And also to do this, but at the same time, promoting the good parts of modernity, he says. And of course, for him, this is the revolution, capital T, capital, this is the proletarian revolution. In this text, he even says, you know, if we want to look for, actually, let me see if I can grab this text.
I found it.
Yeah, if you want to read it out.
you actually beat me to the punch on this one. One of the things that we forgot to talk about was the return, but that's basically what we're talking about right now. And I was going to venture the thesis that there's something like an accelerationist tendency here. This idea of not being able to return and emphasizing that and saying to go beyond, I mean, not in the Nietzschean sense. And so here's the part, I'll just read this part out loud. Absolutely. And then we can chew on it. So the real problem, you say, is to return them. No, I repeat, we are not men for whom it is a question of either or. For us, the problem is not to make a utopian and sterile attempt to repeat the past, but to go beyond. It is not a dead society that we want to revive. We leave that to those who go in for exoticism. Nor is it the present colonial society that we wish to prolong, the most putrid carrion that ever rotted under the sun. It is a new society that we must create with the help of all of our brother slaves, a society rich with all the productive power of modern times, warm with all the fraternity of olden days. That was the one, right?
Mm-hmm. And he fixes the Soviet Union. Oh, he changes his mind later.
He does.
But in terms of the logic of this, I mean, he's turning... I mean, I think this is really actually... I think, Craig, I think you're right. I think if we go back to our episode with Arya Dean about black accelerationism, the idea that the subject has been put under erasure, made into a non-subject, had its history suppressed and erased by the primitive accumulation imposed on it by the European sphere and by capitalism... This is a subject that is what a non-subject, I mean, even to put it on sort of, you know, Harney and Moten terms, is this right for this kind of new consideration of the futurism beyond this mode of subjectivation, beyond the formal humanism that for Césaire gives rise to Hitlerism? And I honestly think that there could be a brilliant accelerationist reading of this. I mean, that is Césaire's point in the quote I read earlier. There's a kind of acceleration of blackness to accelerate the dialectic, because there is a real concrete universal in the African experience here. And there's an active tradition of consciousness, of nourishment through consciousness, of historical resistance that has survived the erasure of racial capitalism, which racial capitalism cannot recognize because it has to erase the very bodies in order to, like, you know, keep itself awake at night, because it's only expanding its own European ideologies. So, as I said earlier, to quote Césaire, and talking to Senghor, the first president of Senegal, so we told ourselves, the blacker we are going to be, the more universal we'll become.
And there are other parts of this text which have led me to characterize Césaire's views as having some resonance with accelerationist tendencies. The very last block quote that he puts in there... And I'll just pick up the part of the essay that I think is most important there. He says, they thought they were only slaughtering Indians or Hindus or South Sea Islanders or Africans. They have, in fact, overthrown one after another the ramparts behind which European civilization could have developed freely. And so what he's going to suggest here is that through this project of civilization and through the strategy of colonization, Europe did itself in. And he continues, I know how fallacious historical parallels are, particularly the one that I'm about to draw. Nevertheless, permit me to quote a page from Edgar Quinet for the not inconsiderable element of truth which it contains and which is worth pondering. And so if you indulge me to read this, I thought this was great. And I think I have a really strong connection here too. People ask why barbarism emerged all at once in ancient civilization. I believe I know the answer. It is surprising that so simple a cause is not obvious to everyone. The system of ancient civilization was composed of a certain number of nationalities, of countries which, although they seemed to be enemies, were even ignorant of each other, protected, supported, and guarded one another. When the expanding Roman Empire undertook to conquer and destroy these groups of nations, they dazzled sophists, thought they saw at the end of this road humanity triumphant in Rome. They talked about the unity of the human spirit. It was only a dream. It happened that these nationalities were so many bulwarks protecting Rome itself. And he goes on and on. And so I'll pick it up a little bit later in the paragraph. The magnanimous Caesar, by crushing the two Gauls, only paved the way for the Teutons. So many societies, so many languages extinguished, so many cities, rights, homes annihilated, created void around Rome in those places which were not invaded by the barbarians. Barbarism was born spontaneously. The vanquished Gauls charge into the Bagauds. Thus, the violent downfall, the progressive extirpation of individual cities caused by the crumbling of ancient civilization, that social edifice was supported by the various nationalities as by so many different columns of marble or porphyry. And then it goes on from there. The point being is this. These empires were insulated by multiplicity. Nations were insulated by multiplicity. By dint of colonization, they did in the substance of empire and now are making a crack for something else new to come through. And it reminds me of what Baudrillard talks about in the topic of the spirit of terrorism. I didn't have that text on me. I had Agony of Power where he talks about that a little bit. But there comes a point in empire at which the power of empire and its tendrils being reached all the way across the globe, that any sort of antagonism to it appears as a form of terrorism. And this is why, with respect to not only the Roman world, but to European and American, Anglo-American civilization, as we know it now, the Atlantic powers, if you will, that it is through the fissures that have developed in the crumbling socioeconomic edifice of our global society that we now have these enforces that create or that let loose these intensities that could become something else. And I think Césaire is, by him pulling that example in, he's giving us a possible image of that future. What does a post-colonization or a decolonial future look like? It's one that is run through with fissures from which these intensities ooze out, these forms of repression, insofar as those intensities are able to assemble and engender an axiomatic that empire itself denied to itself. Anyway. End of episode. That was 1 hour. No, go ahead, Will.
I mean, I just think it's really interesting. Like, we're going to be talking about the apparatus of capture next week. And one of the modes of opposition for a minoritarian politics that Deleuze and Guattari see is that minoritarian politics in its ethos has to be fundamentally incompatible with the axiomatic of capital. It cannot just be a proletarianized counter movement. It has to fundamentally try to escape the plane altogether. And the point about capital and empire that I thought was really interesting is it reminded me of a discussion that Judith Butler and Giorgio Agamben had about the necessity of empire to label all political intensity that falls outside of the parliamentary terroristic. So I think that as we enter these next few reading groups, texts, I think that this might be a recurring theme. Mm.
Did you ever read that part in Baudrillard where he talks about the tsunami as being terroristic or as evil and agony of power?
Well, it's a very abstract force that subsumes all things. It's quite, you know, terrorist in a Hegelian definition, definitely.
Maybe that's one we have to go in on some other time, the agony of power.
Yeah, I had one last bit I wanted to raise, because there's this passage, it's on page 19 of our versions, but where he's still talking about Calvoir, and when I read through this section, I almost got sort of like, almost deja vu, I think, reading this. I just want to read it and then make a few comments on it. So he writes, Mr. Calvoir identifies the enemy no differently. It's those European intellectuals who, for the last 50 years, because of exceptionally sharp disappointment and bitterness, have relentlessly repudiated the various ideals of their culture, and who by doing so maintain, especially in Europe, a tenacious malaise. It is this malaise, this anxiety, which Mr. Calvoir, for his part, means to put an end to. And indeed, no personage since the Englishman of the Victorian age has ever surveyed history with a conscience more serene and less clouded with doubt. His doctrine, it has the virtue of simplicity. That the West invented science, that the West alone knows how to think, that at the borders of the Western world there begins the shadowy realm of primitive thinking, which, dominated by the notion of participation, incapable of logic, is the very model of faulty thinking. End quote. Now, I mean, aside from just the really just vicious kind of comments, satire there that he's delivering, I love that line about no personage since the Englishman of the Victorian age has ever surveyed history with a conscience more serene and less clouded with doubt. But I was reading that and I was thinking, so he's identifying a text, you know, in this essay written in 1950-55, give or take, he's identifying a text when 50 years from that, so about 1900, give or take. And so what we have there is a situation in 1900 where public intellectuals, given places in newspapers and so on, as Carlyle was, were complaining about a civilization that appeared unsure of itself, that was questioning its values and its role in the world and so on, and pushing back against it to defend civilization. Isn't this sort of exactly what we're seeing all across the Western world right now? This same kind of reactionary set of attitudes. I mean, even a bit here, this mixture of ignorance about actual history, you know, the West invented science and invented philosophy and all the rest of it, right? That the way that he talks about that at the borders of the Western world, he says, there begins the shadowy realm of primitive thinking, the model of faulty thinking. It's this dangerous realm, which was described earlier by Carlyle as sort of primitive and dangerous and so on. Isn't this how so much of our discourse right now is exactly the same. You wouldn't have to go very far in any newspaper in Britain, America, France, Germany, etc., to find these kinds of views being repeated today. And so, you know, it's not a great endorsement of any progress made since then, is it? Because, I mean, a lot of that passage, I think you wouldn't have any trouble finding in The Spectator or something.
Spectator or The Sun or The BBC or The Guardian, to be honest, but especially spiked online as usual. I mean, I think there's a certain cause for a pessimism, which is more a kind of a pro-accelerationist argument, because I think this text really does resonate a lot with some of the absolute sort of detesting of Europe that happens from some sort of European leftist thinkers. And I think Bifo's resignation from the sort of, you know, the democratic socialist group DM25 is exemplary of this. We have a few quotes here. So we have naively expected that an alliance of British murderers, French killers, Italian stranglers, German slaughterers, and Spanish slayers could give birth to a democratic, peaceful, friendly union. This pretense is over, and I'm sick of it. Next quote. 5 centuries of colonialism, capitalism, and nationalism have turned Europeans into the enemy of humankind. May they be cursed forever. May Europeans be swept away by the storm they have generated, by the weapons they are building, by the fire they have ignited, by the hatred they have cultivated. To stop the migratory, Euro-Nazism is going to build enormous extermination camps. The non-governmental organizations guilty of rescuing people from the sea will be contained, downsized, criminalized, repressed. The externalization of the European borders means extermination. Extermination is the word that defines the historical mission of Europe. Nazism is the only political form that corresponds to the soul of the European people. I don't think Cézanne would disagree with any of that. Thank you.
Thank you.